under advisement and move to the next case. Southern Illinois Carpenters against RFMS. Mr. O'Hara.
Good morning. My name is Patrick O'Hara. May it please the court, counsel. I represent the trustees of the Southern Illinois Carpenters Welfare Fund. I would like to refer to them as the Carpenters for short form.
Could I ask you two technical questions to begin with? First of all, you were, of course, the plaintiffs originally. Why did you name Mr. and Mrs. Krebs as defendants, since they don't seem to have anything to do with this case? And secondly, you don't seem to have named the administrators of the RFMS fund. You've named the company instead, which does not really seem to be the correct defendant.
The first question, in terms of naming the Krebs, I thought it was important with regard to a declaratory judgment that they be heard with regard to if they had a position as to, because there's a coordination of benefits issue as to, the court could have made a ruling, I think, that may have affected the ability to have a complete and full coverage coverages.
That was my question. I could certainly see if one of the potential outcomes was a no coverage outcome, that they would have an interest. But as I understood this case, it was really all about whether it's $1,000 first from RFMS, then the other $159 from RFMS, as you argue, or if it's $1,000 first from RFMS and the other $159 from Carpenters. And then, you know, if she later has like another $1 million worth of, you know, if somehow she were to exceed what Carpenters can pay, does it bounce back to RFMS? And if that's all it's about, if it's only about whether Plan A or Plan B pays, I don't see why they care.
In order for the Krebs could have had 100% of all bills covered.
Is there any way they could have had less than 100% of
all
bills covered?
Well, I think so, because in order for... I haven't looked at both plans in terms of what they cover, but there could have been deductibles and what have you on one plan or the other.
You didn't look at that? I mean, well,
not for purposes of naming them as parties. I thought that it was important enough that they should be heard for the potentiality of that. I wasn't looking at it from the standpoint of the coordination of benefits coverage.
Yeah.
I was looking at it from the standpoint that they are a potential that they would not have had a benefit from one plan or another, and that they should be heard with regard to the discussion between the two entities. With regard to the latter question as to why I...
But looking at your complaint, you don't, in your complaint, say anything that would put their right to recover at risk. You just want to enjoin RFMS from denying coverage.
That's basically true. I wanted to make certain that I allowed them to be heard with regard to it. And I did think it was, quite frankly, strange that RFMS counsel represented both the company plan and the Krebs individually.
But why is the... that's the other problem. You didn't sue the plan. Or actually, you're not even supposed to sue the plan. You're supposed to sue the administrators of the plan for something like that.
I did name RFMF because it was a single employer plan, and if that was an error, it wasn't raised by RFMS. They've indicated that they were ready to address the issue as to the coordination of benefits and the other matters with respect to it. I did want to point out at the outset that there is a distinction between the Carpenters plan and the RFMS plan, because the Carpenters plan is a multi-employer ERISA plan, as opposed to the RFMS plan, which is a single employer.
But you haven't raised on appeal any arguments that relate to that, even though you had originally said something in your complaint about it.
No, I think it may go into
the
policy aspects of why the Carpenters did what they did. I think the focus in terms of the preservation of the race of a multi-employer plan is for the purposes of ensuring the financial integrity of the plan to provide benefits for all participants.
I think a single employer plan
though has more of a profit motive in terms of the cost to their particular company enterprise as opposed to a multi-employer plan that's derived from contributions from many employers.
Well, I mean, I don't think we need to go there. We've rejected arguments of conflict of interest and the like, but I don't understand why, though, we ought to, or the court ought to defer to your reading of the RFMS plan as constituting a separate standalone plan and the wraparound provision. That's all about their plan, and
well,
it's really not up to you to read it.
If I may respond to that, I take particular issue with the notion, as U.S. District Court ruled, that there is no indication in the language of the RFMS plan that the no-loss provision was intended to operate as a separate plan.
Right.
But we weren't looking at the RFMS plan language to determine that. We were looking at the coordination of benefits language of our plan, the Carpenter's plan.
So why did your plan have anything to do with what they wrote in their plan?
Well, it can happen in any instance where a fund trustees interprets their plan. For example, if there's an exclusion and the trustees are going to make a determination of what their plan says in regards to those circumstances, it's going to interpret either police reports or medical reports or the circumstances of any situation. When the trustees have to make a determination as to whether a set of facts or circumstances fits into their coordination of benefits language or any part of their plan, they're going to have to look at extraneous materials. It just happens to be this particular plan, the RFMS plan.
But it doesn't make it a different plan. I mean, you can interpret it, you can interpret external facts like that, but an ERISA plan is, you know, it's a term of art. And whether something's a plan, sometimes we have arguments that there are single individual plans. I mean, that's a question of law for the court to look at, to
well,
which it would have no reason to defer to anything you've said.
Happily, I don't think it makes a difference. And that's the wonderful thing about the coordination of benefits provisions in the Carpenter's plan, I think, because even if, and I argued this in my reply brief, even if it is not a separate plan, then the no-loss provisions of the RFMS plan has to share, then, the coordination of benefits provisions of the wraparound plan. That's what the court found, that the no-loss provisions as such were a part of, the wraparound plan. Well, the wraparound plan has coordination of benefits language. It doesn't address the situation, but it has coordination of benefits language. If it does, then the coordination of benefits language in the Carpenter's plan provides that if both plans have coordination of benefits language, then the plan that covers the person as an active employee or non-dependent is the plan that pays. So that the no-loss provisions...
So if the Carpenter's plan had a $1,000... limit and then would kick it back?
No. The situation is the Carpenters had a particular plan that says we cover the employees and their spouses and their children, their dependents. The RFMS plan had said we cover our employees, but if the employee has a spouse that covers them, we're only going to pay $1,000. Unless the other plan somehow doesn't cover you as an employee.
But what if their plan had a similar limitation?
As such?
If the Carpenter's plan also were to have a provision that was similar to the...
That's what I'm trying to avoid. That's what I indicated in the first instance, is that we could have ever-escalating...
It's going to be a thousand here, a thousand there,
and it'll never stop. And that's why it's important to realize that this is a situation that's going to arise again and again because of the ever-escalating cost of medical care. I think it's 15 to 22% per year, and ERISA funds are seeing this time and time again, where there is literally employees paying employees to opt out of their insurance so that they can go to their husbands or their wives' ERISA plan as dependents, so that their employers do not have to pay for their employees' medical care.
Well, it surely in the end depends on what the various plans say, which is what the district court has to decide. And if there is one of these mutual finger-pointing situations, the district court will simply have to resolve, given the policies of ERISA, which plan will cover.
And we feel that the trustees made their interpretation. It was not an unreasonable interpretation. It follows exactly their coordination of benefits language and should be deferred to.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. O'Hara. Mr. Riffle?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bob Riffle on behalf of both defendants in the case here today.
And why are the Krebs in this case?
I really don't understand why they would have been named as defendants.
Was there any risk at all? I certainly could see if there was a risk that they might not get the full $160,000, which is what I understand the amount to be at issue, why they would definitely need their voice heard. But this looks to me like a case whether the Carpenters or the RFMS plan paid. And it was clear that one or the other was going to. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. The only possibility, as counsel indicated, is there could be gaps in coverage under both plans, but they weren't put at risk by the coverage dispute here. Clearly one or the other plan will be paying the benefits in question.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Even if we uphold your wraparound plan, is it really equitable to allow you as the primary payer to pay only $1,000 and then shift the burden to the secondary payer to pay the balance? As counsel pointed out, the implications of this are really mind-boggling.
Well,
or could be from the trustee standpoint.
If I could address the implications of the potential of having competing wraparound type of plans, I think the result of that would clearly be that those plans would be mutually repugnant, and therefore the courts would not be bound by the plans themselves, but rather would be reverting to the common law and other rationale to resolve the coordination of benefits provision. Here we've got a case that Judge Field determined the plans were not mutually repugnant. He could read the intent of both plans and fully implement the intent of both plans, which we would respectfully submit is exactly what he did, and he did so correctly. This doomsday scenario that's portrayed, I don't think ever comes to pass, because if both plans choose to employ the exact same wraparound and no-loss provision, they would butt heads. They would be...
Why would they each be responsible for 50%?
Well, they would be mutually repugnant because both of them could not be in a position where they would only pay the first $1,000 and then shift the responsibility over. And at that point, as I understand the case law, they would be determined to be mutually repugnant in that they could not both be implemented as written, and therefore the court would, as you suggest, require both of them to pay 50% of the benefit. But here that's not the case because of the plans are different, but they can be coordinated, and indeed, that's exactly what the court proceeded to do.
I mean, your argument is essentially that you guys wrote a smarter plan, basically, for the short run, that you wrote this plan that if the employee were some single individual with no dependents and no other sources of insurance, you pay everything, but if they are, as Mrs. Krebs was, somebody who's also a dependent on another person's health plan, you get to shift it over to that plan to the extent it pays. You know, maybe if that plan had a cap of $100,000, it would have shifted back to you for the last 60, as I understand the way this works. So your position has to be, you know, for the time being, as written, you guys anticipated more.
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I think it's important to understand what ERISA requires and doesn't require. For instance, a plan could exclude a kidney transplant, which is what is at issue in this case. Some may say that that's not a fair way to proceed, but their plan could have excluded kidney transplants, and under ERISA, we would have been obligated to proceed and pay that. Similarly, ARC plan does not contain discretionary review language. We don't have the advantage of the Firestone v. Brutsch case, where we have the entitlement to interpret our plan. Rather, the court is to interpret our plan in the event of a dispute. So ERISA gives plans broad discretion in terms of what to include and not include. There are limited exceptions, as we point out in our brief. Congress has mandated that certain things be provided, but they have specifically said that other matters aren't required. We think there are a variety of reasons that this case can and should be affirmed on appeal. I want to briefly touch upon the procedural posture of the case. The plaintiffs originally made certain claims in their complaint, have abandoned those three specific grounds on which they criticized the actions of the defendants, and now are proceeding on an entirely new theory. I think it's important to realize that their newfound coordination of benefits argument is really inconsistent with the initial pleadings in the case.
But the district court didn't think this was a new theory. In footnote 9 of the opinion, he says that the complaint specifically references both plans' coordination of benefit provisions. He certainly goes on and decides it.
Yes.
Seems to me, you know, this is late in the day to claim that this is a new argument.
But I do want to point out, not only do they go on a different tack from a theory standpoint, but they also go on a different tack from a factual basis. And I think that's very important for the court to understand. Their initial attack on our plan was that it was an improper fee-shifting document that they were interpreting as shifting the responsibility back on them. Later in the game, they are coming up with a theory that they're reading the coordination of benefits entirely contrary, that you can read the coordination of benefits mutually consistent and put the burden back on us. So we would respectfully submit that they did not interpret the plan as they now say they did. They interpreted it the way we are and have consistently interpreted it, and that, again, they have no right to, first of all, they've got no right to interpret our plan, rather that was solely for the district court to do in the first instance. But even if they got over that hurdle and could somehow interpret our plan, that's not really how they interpreted it at the time the benefits determination was made and at the time the complaint was filed. Rather, at that time, they were interpreting our plan as being a shifting mechanism back into their court. So I think the complaint, although I understand the court's point, that since the district court considered it, certainly this court has discretion to consider that on appeal. But I think, again, the importance of looking back at the complaint and what they originally said, it's still important that in the complaint they attacked the alleged fee-shifting mechanism, and now they're not saying that's a fee-shifting mechanism at all. Rather, they're saying that they're interpreting it in a way that we're required to pay. I don't think there's any logic or support for that. The clear intent of our no-loss provision was to be the payer of last resort. That's how the district court interpreted it. The plaintiffs have never come out and said that the district court's interpretation of our plan was arbitrary and capricious or incorrect. And I think the court in the early questioning was exactly correct. The plaintiffs may have the authority to interpret the provisions of their plan, but only the court has the discretion to interpret the provisions of the RFMS plan. The provisions of the RFMS plan were interpreted, specifically the no-loss provision, to be the payer of last resort. That determination by the court hasn't even been appealed from. And
you would imagine our review of that would be de novo anyway.
I believe that's
the interpretation of the contract.
I believe that's correct, but again, it hasn't even been appealed that Judge Steele got it correct when he interpreted the no-loss provision as being the payer of last resort, and we would respectfully submit that's the only logical interpretation of that provision in any event. Some of their arguments don't even get them all the way to where they need to go in this case. Even if they could somehow overcome the order of payment, they're still stuck with the idea that our no-loss provision, whether it paid second, first, whether we pay first and second or first and third, we still are only required to pay that which is within the express terms of our no-loss provision. And again, that is to be the payer of last resort when all other sources of recovery have been exhausted. For all of those reasons, Your Honors, we would respectfully request that the judgment below be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. O'Hara, your time ran out, but if you would like one more minute, we will give that to you.
Just one point, Your Honor. I would like to point out that the plan, Carpenter's plan, states one of two or more plans involved is the primary plan, while the others, plural, are secondary plans. And if we take a look at the language of the order of payment language, in the coordination of benefits plan and in the Carpenter's plan, it says if part of the other plan coordinates benefits, this is the other plan, and part does not, each part will be treated as a separate plan. So the Carpenters did just that. The no-loss provision doesn't have a coordination of benefits language. Therefore, we look at it as a separate plan pursuant to our coordination of benefits. We looked at the language, and it says that there's a primary payer. That would be the $1,000. And then there are two secondary plans, the no-loss provision and the Carpenters. The question is, who pays between those? And it's very clear from the language of our plan is that if the active, the plan that has the active employee, which would be the RFMS plan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both councils.